Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's time for our weekly reporters roundtable. Joining us today, Mark Kovac, State House reporter for the Youngstown Vindicator. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Good morning.
And Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Karen.
Good morning.
And Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, just blew in. He's a little out of breath. We'll wait to say anything to him. Welcome back, Jim. There's going to be a Democratic primary in the governor's race. Last time we talked about this, people sort of went, well, you know, they've got to get the signatures verified and blah, blah, blah. Well, lo and behold, the signatures have been verified. There is a Democratic primary. Mark Kovac, can you tell us about the man who will challenge Ed Fitzgerald on the Democratic ticket?
Well, his name is Larry Ely. Is it pronounced Ely? Do you guys know?
I think so.
I
talked to Larry on the phone the day after the filing deadline. He's a Dayton area man. From a challenge standpoint, nobody saw this, I don't think, coming. He just kind of came out of the blue, didn't tell anybody, but some of the guys in the jail that he served with that he was going to do this. He has a strong bent toward criminal justice for people who aren't being represented in the African-American community. That's kind of his subject. That's what he's focused on. He's served time. He's had some lawsuits for different issues. He's tried to run for different offices like the mayor of Dayton. Hmm. His signatures didn't work out, I don't think, that time. I think he told me he once sued the city of Dayton for $20 million or something.
Yeah.
He told me he
How'd
was,
he do?
According to the papers, I think he won, but he didn't win any money. I'm not sure. It's all, see, he says he won, but they took the money away from him or something. It's a little bit confusing.
Okay.
Very interesting guy. But I mean, he has no campaign money.
I was going to ask you if you won some money, then maybe.
Yeah, I don't know that you would consider this a serious challenge for Ed Fitzgerald, but it is very interesting. And you know, talking to some of my fellow reporters, you know, the question is, if you're in town and there's dueling press conferences, one with Ed and one with Larry, which one are you going to go to? You know, I'm probably going to go to Larry because that's going to be fascinating. You know, I mean, I know what Ed's going to say, but I don't know what Larry's going to say. So,
well, what do you make of it? I mean, did you talk to him about the fact that he's creating this challenge for the probable winner and that it's the whole idea of the resources that are available? And
And he said, I don't have any money, you know, and people will vote on me based on my abilities or whatever. But he told me, you know, I'm a Democrat and Ed's a nice guy and if I don't win, I'm going to support him. It's not like I'm going to support somebody else. So it's not like he has a beef against Ed Fitzgerald.
Mm-hmm.
He has a beef against people in his community who aren't getting the legal representation that he wants that they need.
It sounds like he's a perennial candidate. And then that's what Democratic Party officials out in Montgomery County had said after he filed and when they thought that he wouldn't even get the signatures to get on the ballot, that he's done this kind of thing before. And you have these throughout the major political parties at all levels, people that just always turn up on the ballot, always try to qualify. And, you know, most of the time they're not serious, but the issue remains of could they steal away some votes and maybe make things a little bit messy for the eventual winner to go on and be a candidate later on.
This is the second time, this time it's stuck, that there was a threat of a primary challenge for Ed Fitzgerald in May. Is all the talk of primary elevated his name at all? Is he any better known for all of this being discussed?
I doubt it.
Jim Siegel?
I doubt it. I mean, because he's, you know, it's been mentioned, but really, I mean, how many people in the state even know Ed Fitzgerald at this point?
Right.
You know, and he's been discussed for months. So, you see candidates like this sometimes. They have a certain thing they want to talk about, an issue they think is not getting enough attention. So they run for a big office and try to draw some attention to that issue. And that's fine. But that's doesn't mean we can cover him somewhat. Doesn't mean he'll be taken real seriously as a true candidate for the office.
It's not like you're going to see expensive commercials or any
right.
kind of statewide presence for Larry anyway. I don't think you will.
Maybe a little notice in Dayton.
Right. Well, and if he's on the ballot across the state, you know, certainly there will be people asking questions. And, you know, obviously, like both Mark and Jim were saying, there's no money here with the Larry Ely campaign. But you know, who knows when you've got a candidate who has nothing to lose, in a sense, who knows what could come out? Who knows what could come out from a primary, quote, campaign and then stick along the way? And so it could... There's always a concern, I think, among the parties when there isn't a locked down candidate and no primary, and they wonder what's going to happen as you go into the fall.
The more interesting challenges to the major parties is going to come in the general election when you've got the Libertarian Party, who has a full slate of candidates running on the statewide tickets. That'll be more of where they get some more, you know, the challengers get more attention, and it may, there is some apparatus there for them to actually get out there. Now, I'm not saying they're going to go out there and buy up a bunch of 30-second TV spots, but they do have some structure there that they can, you know, they can do some organizing and get, try to get their message out a bit.
But it's still absolutely fascinating that this guy could go out, you know, and nobody knows that he's out collecting his own signatures, and he manages to get enough to get on the ballot for the gubernatorial primary. That's just fascinating to me. Nobody saw him coming.
Hey, it's democracy.
Great story, you know.
Yeah. I agree. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We have a reporters roundtable today with Kieran Kassler of Ohio Public Radio, State House News Bureau, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, and Mark Kovac of the Youngstown Vindicator. If there's an issue pending at the State House you have a question about, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org and post your question or comment there. Or, I'm sorry, you can also go to Facebook and post your question or comment there. And you can tweet us as well at WOSU All Sides. Let's talk about the governor now. He's been giving lots of interviews. He's been doing editorial boards, kind of getting out there in the rubber chicken circuit with all the Lincoln Day dinners. 'Tis the season. He's saying that right-to-work legislation is not on his agenda. He says that right now we have labor peace in Ohio. What do we make of that?
Well, I know what the Democrats make of it.
Yeah.
They keep reminding reporters and others that that comment, it's not on my agenda, is almost a total word-for-word comment that Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, made as he was in the midst of a reelection campaign when he was reelected. Right-to-work, or so-called right-to-work, did indeed go into effect. And so Democrats will be reminding their supporters that Kasich has not directly denied it and has just said this that we heard before in Michigan. Of course, Kasich has said it's not on his agenda and that he can't help if other people bring it forward, if the Tea Party brings it forward, if it comes to the legislature. But it's interesting that his comments about this have not been, I would veto it, I won't sign it, whatever, rather than it's not on my agenda.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that the governor has signed since he got into office that were not on his agenda, but things that the legislature passed, things that they put into bills, put into the budget bill that maybe the governor wasn't exactly looking for, but he signed it anyway because he didn't necessarily disagree with it. I think the non-denial denials that the governor's been giving has left the door open for those who want to say that this could be a very real possibility down the road. I mean, I think his last comment, I don't remember the exact quote, but it talked about you can live in the future, but I don't have to, or something of that effect.
I was just going to bring that up, that I'm not confused by it. I'm intrigued by it, because isn't that what candidates are doing?
That's what a campaign's called, you know,
of talking about the future. For a political office, it's about the future. And Mark Kovac, is this what people, you know, I mean, is this, what do you make of this? It worked for Rick Snyder.
Well, he's been, ever since Senate Bill 5, he will not touch right to work. I mean, and he says this exact same thing, and you try to press
because,
him on it. You don't want to bring up Senate Bill 5 into the coming campaign. You don't want to remind people of that whole debacle that happened in his first term. They don't want that to be a talking point.
First Senate Bill 5, then issue 2 on the ballot,
yes,
when the voters
yes.
just trashed
yes.
it.
Yes, and I mean, the thing that Democrats are hammering on over and over again with the right to work thing is, if Governor Kasich is reelected, you absolutely will see right to work. And they are saying that over and over again. They need that issue going into the campaign.
If he keeps saying he's not doing it, is he doing himself any favors among more right, you know, more of that right wing of the party, the more conservative elements in the Republican Party, the Tea Party folks for example?
Well, I think it depends on what elements on the right you're talking about. Would conservatives love to see him come out and say, I support right to work? Absolutely they would. However, those who are politically savvy enough to know that doing so simply excites the Democratic base and gets mm-hmm. more of their voters out, I think they also realize that by just having him say, you know, it's not on my agenda, they too can see that and say, well, that doesn't shut the door on it. So, I mean, I think it, you know, I think it depends on, you know, whether or not you are really looking toward the next election or not, as to whether you really want him to come out and say, I am a fan of right to work.
The biggest threat of a primary challenge was from the Tea Party against John Kasich. That had never materialized. But does that what do we know about that part of the party, if you will, that branch and its support for John Kasich?
Well, we do know that they've got the Tea Party activists have people in various House and Senate districts.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I'm thinking of primarily, which is interesting, is you talk about Senate Bill 5, Shannon Jones, the Republican state senator who brought forward Senate Bill 5,
right.
She actually has a Tea Party challenger, which is interesting because she was the person who brought Senate Bill 5 forward.
And
she
carried the proverbial water.
Yes. And in fact, her Tea Party challenger, I believe, is Kelly Coles, who would have been the lieutenant governor candidate if indeed the Tea Party group had gotten their last team that they talked about onto the ballot. It was supposed to be a veterinarian from the Youngstown area named Donald Allen and Kelly Coles. And so it's you're going to see Tea Party candidates on the ballot in other districts, and it'll be interesting to see how they fare after the May primary.
Yeah, there's a number of Tea Party candidates running in legislative races against incumbents.
Doable.
Yes, that's a better race if you're if you don't have the infrastructure, that's a better race for you to win, especially in a primary. But, you know, a number of them are, some want to see the heartbeat bill passed. This is the bill that would ban abortions after a heartbeat is detected. Some of them want to see Common Core they want to see Ohio get rid of Common Core.
Education standards.
Education standards. And some of them just running against folks, they don't, you know, some of them are mad about the Medicaid issue. Like Barbara Sears is facing a challenge, as was expected, because she supported Medicaid expansion up there in the Toledo area. So, mm-hmm. So yeah, there are going to be a number of primaries. The good thing for if you're a House Republican or a Senate Republican, the good thing is that your party has so much money, so much more money than the Democrats, that even if each side blows $2 million in a primary, which isn't going to happen, but even if they did, they'd still have plenty of leftover to run in the general election.
Oh, I'm just so reassured by that. So, my guests, Karen Kassler, Ohio Public Radio, State House News Bureau, Mark Kovac of the Youngstown Vindicator, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, will all return and continue our conversation about state government politics and other items in the news. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Going back to the statewide races with my guests, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, Karen Kassler of Ohio Public Radio, and Mark Kovac of the Youngstown Vindicator. What other races should we be paying attention to? Now, I know, tell me what you think.
Well, I mean, all of the five executive offices are up this time, governor, auditor, attorney general, treasurer, mm-hmm. and secretary of state. And all of them have major party candidates, as well as Jim was saying, libertarian candidates, which is pretty interesting. I'm trying to remember the last time that happened. But you have some people who are predicting certain races might be interesting to watch. The treasurer's race with Josh Mandel, who's coming off what happened in 2012, which
Senate
some people
mm-hmm.
believe was kind of a disastrous race for him. He still, though, is raising lots of money. Representative Connie Pillich, the Democrat from Cincinnati, who is his opponent in that race, the major party opponent. She hasn't raised as much as he has, obviously. But there are some folks who are saying that would be a good race. I think the race between Secretary of State John Husted and State Senator Nina Turner could be potentially interesting, because Nina Turner is certainly an interesting personality to watch. She's a very charismatic person, and so is John Houston, and they're totally different personalities. I think it could be a really interesting race.
They're totally different personalities, but are they totally on the different sides of the issues necessarily?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Nina Turner is, she's, you know, she has a very liberal view of how elections should be run, which is get as many people to the polls and give them as much opportunity to vote as possible. John Husted has tried to walk some middle of the road on his policies, and and frankly, being Secretary of State is a difficult job because you're in charge of the elections. However, there are really 88 Board of Elections who run the elections, so it's always a tough thing to try to manage. But there are a lot of things that she's going to go after him on early voting and different things that she thinks should be more open. There's an early voting bill right now that's going to probably pass the House sometime this week, and mm-hmm. We'll cut down early voting by a week, and she's been very opposed to that. So, while John Husted's been okay with it. There'll be a lot of contrast there, and if you know Nina Turner, even where there might be not so much contrast, she can still talk it up and make you think that the two of them are worlds apart.
How long has she been? She's been in the
Senate,
right? Yeah. Is this her first term?
No. I think this is her second term.
She was appointed first time, wasn't she?
Maybe, yeah, she's been there more than 2 years, but I can't remember exactly how long.
She's had a lot of national exposure. I mean, it seems like she's on MSNBC or whatever every other day, it seems like, talking about these issues. And the legislature is moving bills, or at least debating some bills, that gives her a lot to talk about, mm-hmm. like the one Jim mentioned, which closes Golden Week, that week period where you can register to vote and cast ballots at the same time. There's another bill on the absentee ballot bill that is, I don't know if that, is that headed for a floor vote this
yes.
week?
Yes.
Yes. Yep.
You know that she's opposed to, I'm assuming she's opposed to that because Democrats have taken a pretty hard stance against that. There's a provisional ballot bill that I think is up for a vote in committee this week. So there's a constant stream of these bills. And then there's another bill that would shorten the early voting period even more by Representative Becker that is up for a second hearing in committee this week. So there seems like there's constantly something to talk about there.
Well, that's not very good for John Husted then, because he's on the defensive.
Well, I think the whole issue is to try to get some of this stuff resolved before, at least before the primary, if not mm-hmm. long before the November vote, because no matter which side you're on, the whole idea of things being in flux as you go into a big election in November is very confusing for everybody. And so I think there are a lot of folks who really want to get this resolved and don't have to resort to lawsuits. If you remember in 2012, there was a big lawsuit over the final weekend of early voting and whether that would happen. And it ended up happening, but there were some lines in some places, and it was a pretty chaotic situation. So I think a lot of folks want to get this election stuff done as early as possible just to get the rules set.
And the legislature really hasn't done John Husted any favors lately. On two issues, particularly one, he has asked them to set not only to, you know, if you want to reduce by a week the early voting, you know, he's okay with that, but he wants them to set the hours in law, but they won't do that. They're going to leave that up to him and make him do it by directive, which will then, no matter what he does, it's going to be criticized because he's either giving too much or too little, more likely the too little argument by Democrats. And then he has pushed very hard for an online voter registration system that, frankly, Democrats are very supportive of. And legislative Republicans have refused to bring that up for a vote or refused to move on. There's bills in both chambers sponsored by a Democrat and a Republican. There's been no movement at all on that. There's the talk among those who support it say that privately that there's concerns about who it would help, that around university campuses and those with, you know, maybe heavier Democratic populations, that those would be the ones who would utilize that more. So there's concern about passing it. I haven't heard any Republicans say that, but they're not, you know, so there's an issue where he could stand up and say, look, I'm trying to get something done that's truly bipartisan, and they're not helping him with that.
And some of the critics would say that Husted has the authority and could do some of these things on his own by directive, but Husted says, I'm not. This is what the law says. I'm gonna, and he's real careful. He says, I'm gonna issue my directive based on the only bipartisan approved plan I know, which is the one that's been provided by bipartisan county boards of elections, their association. And so that's what he says he's basing his directives on, short of the legislature coming back with their own kind of plan and putting it into law.
And by the way, he hasn't exactly been helpful to the legislature either, or his Republican fellow Republicans in the legislature as they move these bills, because he continues to insist there isn't a level of voter fraud that would necessarily warrant some of these changes.
Right. Well, he's just reading statistics. I mean, the talk about fraud, I mean, you know, there just really doesn't exist on any
basically
level that's
negligible.
Noticeable. Yeah. So
yeah, his own office has said that.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's just, again, he's trying not to be a partisan on that. I'm sure if John Husted and the county boards found a wave of fraud across the state, John Husted would probably get up and have a very different message. But the fact is that some of these bills, and not all of them, but some of them that are being driven by this idea that we need to crack down on voter fraud, John Husted basically saying, you know, says, look, it's just not there.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. These bills are all, you say they're going to the floor this week. Some of them, the second floor, I mean, have they moved on to the next chamber and they're going to the floor? Or?
Yeah, the specific ones, eliminating the Golden Week and shortening the early voting period. That was a Senate bill. It's now going to the House floor.
Okay.
As well as the one that would allow only John Husted and not the individual boards of elections to send out unsolicited absentee ballot applications. Both those will be on the House floor. They started in the Senate. So if they pass, you know, if there are changes made, then they have to go to conference committee. But
right.
This is the last step for them for the most part.
And the governor has said...
Governor says what he always says. Send it to me and I'll tell you what I think about it. I'm doing my own thing here. And
he doesn't
legislature
typically,
does his own thing.
Yeah.
He's
governor,
not looking to the future there.
The governor says he never weighs in on legislation until he wants to weigh in on legislation. And that's the way it's been.
Yep.
So it's the way it'll be.
All righty. Stan in Lithopolis, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Stan.
Okay. My question is, are the Democrats in the election bringing up where Ohio has a $1.4 billion surplus in its budget, but seems like the legislature is still cutting funds to local governments and schools? I get the feeling that nobody's addressing this.
Oh,
what does the rest of your people think?
That was the topic of discussion last week when Ed Fitzgerald and Republican Senate President Keith Faber spoke to the Ohio Township Association, and Ed Fitzgerald, that's what he hammered on the whole time. Yeah, there's this budget surplus, and they claim that they're doing well, but they're doing it on the backs of schools and local governments where they've cut local government funds.
And you don't get more local than township.
Now, the Republican side of that is, you know, 85% of the stuff we do in our budget here goes back to the local governments. You know, we've got a long list of newspaper editorials and newspaper accounts of local governments with budget surpluses. You know, it doesn't really add up. So there's two sides of that, but that's going to be a main theme of this campaign coming up.
Thanks a lot, Stan, for that call. What are some other big themes that are going to be out there? Local government, funding?
The economy, and jobs. There's going to be and this is, by the time it's over, voters' heads are going to be spinning about the way that the jobs numbers are presented. It's not because you know, as with any statistic, you can manipulate it, or you can cherry pick the ones you like to make your point. And both parties do it. When Governor Kasich talks about jobs, he often will mention the number of private sector jobs created. He ignores the fact that there are a lot of public sector job losses during that same time that severely cut into that number, and that Ohio, when it comes on a percentage of job growth, is, you know, ranks pretty low, ranks in the somewhere in the mid-40s among states. You know, you're going to hear a lot of different jobs numbers, and you know, this Ormet thing out in the aluminum plant out east did the governor do enough there? I mean, that's going to be a key theme.
Kieran, you've written a little bit about that. There's a bill pending that would give the governor power to terminate agreements between some companies and their utility providers. This has to do with Ormet. It said it couldn't change its deal with one of its utilities.
Right. It had a deal with AEP. And a negotiated contract, I guess, and went to the Public Utilities Commission and said, if we're held to this deal, we'll go bankrupt. Public Utilities Commission then agreed to lower their rate somewhat, but not as significantly as Ormet wanted. Ormet then said, can we cancel the contract and go to retail choice? And the PUCO said, we can't do that. And so that's when Ormet said, we're going to close the aluminum smelting plant out in eastern Ohio. It's along the Ohio River near West Virginia. And so Democrats...
Quite a few jobs.
What's that?
Quite a few jobs.
Yeah, a couple hundred, several hundred, close to 1,000. And of course, Democrats have been bringing this up, saying these are unionized steel jobs, they're good jobs, and that the governor has not been talking about it. And really, the governor hasn't been talking about it. But his office has said that he can't do anything about it. He can't step in between the PUCO and Ormet. And so this bill from Representative Jack Serra, who is a Democrat in that area, and Ormet is in his district, has said that, you know, his bill would allow the governor to do just that, to step in when there's this dispute between certain companies and their utility provider. But, you know, the question is always, well, if you put that into place for Ormet, what happens with others? Mm-hmm. And so those are the kind of questions that are going to be asked. But Democrats are certainly going to bring up Ormet as an example of jobs that have been lost under Kasich as they go through the whole campaign.
It's the Kasich version of what was Strickland's. NCR, is that the name of the company that
oh,
left?
Yes,
and Republicans
yes.
said, you didn't do anything to get that company to stay here. You should have stepped in and done more.
And DHL also is another.
Same way.
Yep.
That the Republicans would work at the speed of business instead.
Right. Well, and it's a fascinating debate mm-hmm. that is not going to end here, is that how much is it relying on government to step in and save these companies that on their own can't seem to survive. Now the government hands out all kinds of subsidies, tax credits, grants, low interest loans through their economic development realm. But at what point, you know, now you want it. Now, if this were to pass, you'd add in the PUCO and the utility rates. The governor could step in and kind of redo those as well. I mean, there's always this great debate about just how much government should be doing in these cases, because, you know, we're talking about taxpayer money. Those Ormet deals are paid for by other customers out there, other utility customers. And so you end up with, you know, it's not free money they give to Ormet. So there's this. You know, it's an ongoing debate.
And I think there's a debate, too, about the, you know, it's important to remember there are hundreds of people out of work with Ormet, close to 1,000. But there are some questions about whether the payroll down there would be greater than the benefit that would be extended if indeed Ormet were kept open. And so, you know, Kasich talks about being willing to give certain benefits to companies, but he wants a return on investment. He wants it to be, in his view, responsible. And so those are going to be issues.
And hasn't he kind of changed his tune on incentives since he
yes.
took office? I mean, he's now will say, you know, we're not going to give money out
yep.
if it doesn't make sense. You know, if company says we're leaving if you don't give us money, you know, go ahead and go. He's said something to that extent.
Yeah.
So he's changed his tune a little bit on the
incentive. Oh, absolutely.
Thing.
And he's also said he won't get into bidding wars. He wants things to be a little bit more, a little bit less competitive, at least in that regard, and that, you know, there is something to show for it in the end. At least that's what he's telling us.
He has said that he wants to get the state income tax below 4%.
He said that. That was the linchpin of his announcement of that he was going to run for governor.
So how does he achieve that at this point?
Well, he's going to have to find revenue, or you're going to have to reduce spending. I mean, there's a severance.
There's not enough of a surplus to.
Well, no. And let's be clear, is when we're talking about surplus, there's no real surplus in the current budget. There's a rainy day fund that we've been able to build up because of surpluses in the past budget. Now, in this current budget, we're running about even with estimates. So there's no expectation at this moment of a surplus. But, you know, that said, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. Where were we?
Surplus.
Income tax.
Income tax.
Yeah, right.
Sorry. Yeah. I just want to mention, when he talks about reducing the rate on the income tax, people have to remember, and I try to point this out all the time, we're talking about the top rate. The rate that's paid on income made over $203,000. So you're talking about a rate that's paid by 2.5% of the population on only a portion of their income. So, you know, most Ohioans pay somewhere in the range of about 2.5% currently on the income tax. So I just, you know, whenever you hear talk about income tax cuts, all the talk is about the top rate, but that impacts almost nobody.
Okay. Death penalty, doesn't matter. He's sticking to his guns on that, but he has at least halted the next one coming up.
Right. The next one has been delayed until November. I think they're still waiting on a final result and report from the prisons department on Dennis McGuire's execution. The preliminary report said that, I believe it was pretty much, there was nothing that happened in Dennis McGuire's execution that would prevent the next one from going forward.
Mm-hmm.
But I think with all the questions that have been raised about that, I think the governor had wanted a little bit more time. So that puts the next execution in May, I believe, that could be this same method of lethal injection with these two drugs that have only been used once before.
And the prison department is very closed-mouthed about all of this. They're, you know, I've asked them, you know, is the next person going to be executed using two drugs? Have you found a supplier of the single drug injection? You know, what's going on with all of this? And it's always no comment, no comment, no comment. We're doing the review. And it, just remember about the earlier reviews that came out, those are kind of off-the-cuff initial assessments. And but they said clearly, you know, we don't think there needs to be any changes made to the process.
Okay, we are going to continue our conversation with our guest, Jim Siegel of The Dispatch, Karen Kassler, Ohio Public Radio, and Mark Kovac of the Youngstown Vindicator. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We have our reporter roundtable today. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. With us, Karen Kassler of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Mark Kovac of the Youngstown Vindicator, and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. So let's look at some legislation. There's some bills out there to reduce infant mortality in Ohio. Mark Kovac, you've written about that.
I have.
What's the challenge here?
Well, I guess the challenge is there are a lot of people in poorer communities who aren't getting the type of services while they're pregnant and after they give birth to keep them healthy and keep their babies healthy. And so there is a move. There was a press conference last week announcing the introduction of, what was it, five different bills related to infant mortality to try to get these people better services. It was a press conference at a church that has a weekly program that provides a healthy meal to mothers and some assistance to get healthy food during the week. And so the goal is, I mean, we apparently rank near the bottom in the country in terms of how many children are born in the state who don't live to their first birthday. That's a pretty sad statistic. So they've designed some legislation. I'm trying to think of what the bills would do to some increased reporting about sudden infant death syndrome.
Okay.
There's a pilot program. All this is slipping by my head. Were you there last week for that?
I wasn't, no.
Excellent.
whatever you say, I'm going
to provide maybe some more Medicaid coverage for postpartum non-medical services,
okay,
that kind of thing. So,
okay.
I mean, drawing more attention to the issue and trying to get more funding and services to these women and their families who need it.
And a bipartisan effort, too. Shannon Jones, the Republican state senator I mentioned earlier,
yeah,
teaming up with Democratic state senator Charlita Tavares from Columbus. So
this is unusual.
Those two senators teaming up is very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. They said that in 2012, 1,045 babies died in Ohio before their first birthday. So that's just terrible. So
e-cigarette ban for minors clears legislature despite objections. What are the objections, Karen?
Well, there were objections in the House, but apparently not in the Senate because it passed the Senate unanimously. In the House, the objections were that it didn't go far enough. Because you've got some Democrats, about 25 Democrats voted against it in the House. They felt like the bill needed to be stronger with regard to how e-cigarettes are characterized and categorized. Because e-cigarettes right now, they're so new that there really isn't a ton of regulation on them. And so what this bill just did was to put them in a category called alternative nicotine products and said that these alternative nicotine products cannot be bought or possessed by people under 18. And Democrats wanted to see them actually regulated as tobacco products are, and therefore they would be subject to the indoor smoking ban and some of these other things. But the backers of this bill, which I should note, also include the tobacco industry, because Lorillard, the third largest maker of cigarettes and a recent purchaser of an e-cigarette company, actually worked with Representative Stephanie Coonsey of Hilliard to come up with this bill. And they created this new category on the basis of there isn't a whole lot of information known about e-cigarettes. And so until the data comes in, we don't know how dangerous they are or they aren't. So putting them into this new category as opposed to putting them into a established category where we have data on how dangerous that established category is, that was their preferred method.
Yeah, the American Cancer Society and some others have been, Lung Association and others have been concerned because, you know, this is a similar bill to one that's being pushed across the country by the tobacco industry. And, you know, of course, it raises red flags to them whenever you have a tobacco industry written bill that appears to, you know, try to limit the sale of these products to minors. But it's, you know, then they start wondering, well, what's this really about? And their concern is that what it's really about is in the future ensuring that these products are not taxed like cigarettes. Cigarettes are taxed at $1.25 a pack in Ohio. Whereas right now, I believe these products would simply be subject to the state sales tax.
Has the definition been changed anywhere else in the country?
There are a couple of states that I believe have been working on this. Like Jim said, it's been working its way through in mm-hmm. different ways and different forms. But like I said, these e-cigarettes have grown in popularity dramatically. The big concern for the lawmakers who were pushing this was that recent stats show that the numbers of kids, you know, middle and high school students trying them has just exploded. And so they wanted to, as they put it, get these things regulated to the point where kids couldn't get them. And then later we could talk about how to tax them or whatever. But obviously, like I said, some folks feel like it didn't go far enough. They wanted to make sure that this new category didn't preserve e-cigarettes and other alternative nicotine products as something that couldn't be taxed at a higher rate if it turns out they are dangerous.
Some are concerned that e-cigarettes could be sort of a gateway nicotine drug. It gets you hooked. You could start using e-cigarettes and
get hooked
on
nicotine. These things have nicotine in them. They're
right.
Not without risk. They are not, I mean, some...
There's a drug in them.
Very, very few, but some don't have any nicotine in them. But, you know, the draw of these things is that you can smoke them indoors, though in certain places you'll even see signs up now that you can't, because they produce a vapor rather than smoke, and they don't produce any ash. Absolutely do have nicotine in them.
Right, and they're flavored with, you know, candy flavors and chocolate and root beer and all kinds of different flavors that would appeal to kids.
Yep.
And that's, again, this is where when you talk to the American Cancer Society about this, and I've talked with them at length about it, they say that, you know, in their experience nationally, bans on youth sales are probably the least effective way to stop a nicotine product from getting to youth. They say that the best way is more taxation. If you make it so that they can't afford it, then they'll stop purchasing it. But so that's where they think, you know, and again, the tobacco companies disagree with this, but the concern among the Cancer Society is that this is being done is because they're giving away very little by putting a ban in place, but they're getting some protection from future taxation.
I've said this before, and I haven't been corrected, so I'm hoping it's still right, that the ban on smoking on the OSU campus is complete, and it includes e-cigarettes.
I don't know. Unless it was written into that ban, mm-hmm. it may or may not.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, like I said, if this e-cigarette legislation that just passed the House and Senate goes forward and is signed by the governor, it does not put e-cigarettes into that indoor smoking ban.
Okay.
So unless OSU wrote it into their ban specifically, this may or may not be part of it.
And they're not currently under the ban either. They're not currently e-cigarettes are not currently covered.
So you can use one in a bar or in a restaurant.
Yeah, but you'll see, I went to a movie theater this weekend and it even noted on the screen that you couldn't smoke an e-cigarette in the movie theater, which just still blows my mind, because who would even think at this point after this long that you could smoke anything in a movie theater, you know? It's kind of like smoking on an airplane. Who would even think of this at this point? It's been so many years since you could actually smoke on an airplane, you know?
Yeah. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have a question or comment, want to talk about state government or politics, I am told that it is definitely included in the ban at Ohio State, which is a complete and total and utter unmitigated ban of all smoking materials or pseudo-smoking materials anywhere on campus, not just indoor, but anywhere on campus. So there you go. There is another bill that's lawmakers are looking at that would allow an addict's family or friends to give a drug that can halt an overdose from heroin. I think it's really interesting what they're proposing right now. It's just people in the medical field that do rescues and that kind of thing, the EMS type people that have access to it. And a mother is saying, I might have saved my son if I would have had access to that. It's like an EpiPen type of thing or something. Do you guys know anything about that? No one's looking at me. Okay.
It's past the House already, didn't it? Isn't it in the Senate right now?
I believe so. And it's passed. It's another one of these that has been done in several other states.
Okay.
The whole idea being that you put these, like you said, EpiPen-looking things in the hands of people who know that they have addicts in their family or they know the friend that they live with is an addict. The concern has been that maybe people would intentionally try to overdose knowing that this drug is there to rescue them. But addicts have been saying that is not the case, that that's not how addicts think. And so that this is something really just to save someone's life, and then addiction and recovery and all that stuff is dealt with
It's not like a synthetic heroin type of thing. It's something that actually stops the overdose.
That's my understanding.
Starts them
yeah.
breathing again, right? So it's not as if you could abuse it or...
Right, and it's not, like I said, it's not as if people would go ahead and try to overdose knowing that it's there to save them. It would be like a safety net. You know, the people who have spoken out in favor of this say that that's just not how people who could potentially overdose think. This is just a way to make sure that people don't die as they're waiting for the emergency crews to arrive.
Somebody brought up Representative Pete Beck earlier. And Pete Beck is in the news quite a bit down in Southwest Ohio. A grand jury's brought 53 new charges, including an alleged pattern of corruption against him. He's a state legislator already facing trial on felony charges of security fraud, thefts, and other counts. What's going on with this guy?
Well, you could spend another hour discussing this case only because there's so many layers and complexities to it. But basically, he was involved in a investment deal down in Southwest Ohio that involved investors giving to a kind of an umbrella company, and then that company was supposed to funnel down money and invest in these, like a portfolio of startup businesses. One of those startup businesses, Representative Peter Beck, was the CFO, and the accusations is that he also helped solicit investments into that company, a company called C-Tech. It's a software startup firm. And, well, a lot of the money ended up, there was the guy who was kind of in charge of it all, a lot of it ended up in his pocket, ended up with his wife, ended up with a church that the attorney general says was nothing more than a cult, ended up in Peter Beck's campaign account. And so these companies failed and the investors lost their money, and now there's lawsuits and now there's a whole host of criminal charges filed against not only Peter Beck, but others involved in the, in the deal. So, he has maintained his innocence. He has said, look, I've been as much of a victim of this as anyone. I didn't make any money on this. But it involves his old accounting firm partners are suing him. It's a big giant mess down there, and it's leaving the House Republicans a little bit in a lurch as to what they're going to do about it. You know, they pulled him off of his committee chairmanship. He's been working on some major bills as chairman of Ways and Means Committee since he was initially indicted on 16 counts. But they've now pulled him off of that chairmanship. I got to imagine there's some pressure for him to step down. Based on the statements I've seen from his attorneys, I'd be surprised if he did at this point.
You'd be surprised if he did step down.
Right.
Can they force him out?
But it's a big process. I mean, you have to get like a 2/3 vote of the House, and you have to meet some thresholds, and I don't know exactly how it works, but because he's indicted and hasn't been convicted of anything yet, it's difficult to make the argument that he deserves to be thrown out at this point.
Is he on the ballot?
Yes,
in November?
And he has a primary, and from what I understand, it's a tough primary. He raised less than $7,000 last year with this cloud hanging over him. Did not make it easy for him to raise money. And so I do think he's probably in big trouble, even if he is found to be innocent.
The politics on this is interesting because the speaker last year issued a statement after the initial indictments came out, you know, urging him to resign or, you know, to step down from his chairmanship or whatever. And he didn't. And I asked him about it a couple months later. And I didn't mean for him to leave. I just think it's going to be rough on his family. And he, you know, it's a lot to deal with these kinds of legal situations. That's what I meant. I didn't mean that we should kick him out right away. But then this happened. And then we got another statement saying, you know, well, now we've agreed that he's going to step down from that position. And I really think he should, you know, resign and focus on this stuff. So it's just if it was when there had been members of the other party who faced indictments, there were a lot stronger statements in response to those activities than there have been. I mean, Representative Beck has been sitting as a chairman, and didn't he have regional hearings last summer on issues, and he's the severance tax bill is there in his committee, and there's a lot of attention there, and it seems odd that he's still, you know, he lasted there that long.
Anything not getting done because of this?
I don't think so. I mean, part of the issue is that this largely, except for the money that's gone into his campaign account, this has largely been an issue in his private world, his private business interests, and hasn't really bled much into his public problem or his public office. Some of the issues with some past lawmakers have, you know, there have been, issues with their public office, bribery and illegal use of campaign funds and such that have sent them to prison. But he faces, I think, 406 years or something of total prison time at this point.
He had 16 original, and now there's 53 new.
Yes. Yeah, so
that's a Jim, boatload.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but when Representative Lucky, wasn't he indicted when the speaker said to us that he may have to have the patrol come and block his entrance into the chamber?
Yes.
He wasn't convicted yet. He was still just indicted, right? Remember that?
Oh, I remember.
And same speaker?
And it very quickly was backtracked because no one could find any authority to do that, even if, I don't know.
It's still a democracy. There's got to be a process, right? So what else is coming up this week that we should look for?
Calamity Day's vote, maybe?
Ah, yeah.
That was scheduled for last week.
Along with a warming trend. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I hear, you know, I was on Columbus on the Record on Friday, and I predicted that the winter was coming to an end, which of course means there is more snow coming. I got to stop making predictions. But this Calamity Day's bill is interesting because it was scheduled for a vote last week, and they backed off of it, saying they wanted another week to analyze the cost and this sort of thing. But what a lot of people have been hearing is lawmakers being very concerned about teachers. And if you give more calamity days, these are days that teachers get paid for not being in the classroom. And there's some concerns about that as well.
Yeah, which is to me is really funny because they're concerned about, you know, the school personnel and teachers getting paid for days or not in the classroom. But looking ahead to next year, they have changed the school calendar. It's no longer a day's calendar next year. It's an hours. It's a minimum hours. And they have set the hours threshold so low. These same folks who are concerned about teachers not being in class and teaching, the hours threshold is so low that many districts can miss 7, 8, 9, 10 days next year and not have to make any of them up and not have to ask the legislature for more days. It's to me, it's very curious that, you know, you're worried about it this year, but next year you gave them such a low bar to jump over that you could have the exact same thing go on and they don't even need to come ask you for more days.
Well, we'll probably talk about that next week and see what's happened. See if you predicted that spring was coming or something crazy like that.
I thought we were at the end. You know, I don't know. Even it was snowing on the way over to Kosai to go do the show on Friday, and I stupidly said, "I think we're at the end of this." Oh my God! I think I was blinded by spring training and baseball starting. So
well, I hope it doesn't end. I hope we stay cold and non-slushy, muddy for several more weeks. Thanks to Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch for joining us today. Also, Karen Kassler, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Mark Kovac of the Youngstown Vindicator. Thanks to all of you for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.